Very good. Let's get started.
You'll notice something in Matthew, the first chapter. It might be good just for pedagogical purposes if you turn with me to Matthew chapter 1. This is real quick. Probably could do it without making the reference itself. But Matthew 1 puts two names together that we may not have been cognizant of before. This is the genealogy. Begins with Abraham. And in verse 5, we read Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. Well, one reason that I think Ruth is a separate book from Judges is that it is the bridge. It's the bridge between Joshua and Judges and Samuel. Remember the refrain that goes throughout Judges? They had no king, and they did as they pleased. Well, that's one, I think, particular reason for sectioning Ruth out, even though it's a literary masterpiece that is ought to be separate from and is not part of the flow of Judges. The other aspect that's interesting, we started with Rahab and Joshua, and we're ending with Ruth. And here their names are both together in the genealogy. Now, I think we misinterpret this if we think that Rahab was the mother of Boaz. She is in the ancestral line to Boaz, but she isn't the actual first mother of Boaz. A better translation would be that whether grandmother, great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother, there's too many years between Rahab and Boaz. So it's partly understanding how they put genealogies together. And someone like, let me pick a famous biblical scholar that is known for his conservative stance, somebody like Don Carson, says that what takes place here is the telescoping. You're taking the lead name of Rahab and you're bringing it right down to Boaz, and names in between are skipped. That's how you should read, I think, the genealogy in Matthew and Luke as well. But for our purposes, Rahab and Boaz are kind of in the same line, the same sentence. We started with Rahab, we're ending with Ruth, which I think helps. You realize that Westerners would give a certain interpretation of the book of Ruth that might romanticize it, turn it into a love story. There's a lot of love in this story, but it's really not a Western romance. It's not that kind of love story. It's much more a salvation history story, a redemption story. When I counsel people who are planning on marriage, I talk about two loves, the greater love and the lesser love. And the greater love is God's love for us, and the lesser love is the love between a husband and wife. That only shows how great the love is when you compare those two. So this is a story about two loves. God's love for us, as is manifest in this salvation story, this real salvation history, and the love between Ruth and Boaz, which was certainly more a matter of, from Boaz's standpoint and Ruth's standpoint, more a matter of redemption than romance. More a matter of obedience to God's will for the family line than it was kind of falling in love, as we might think of college students today. Probably important to emphasize that. Another aspect of the literary character of this book is scholars have put, and let me just sort of say this is something you could follow up on. I don't think the details are what's so important is, but one scholar has put 10 episodes at the front end of Ruth, and then the pivotal point when Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz all come together in the scheme of bringing them together, where Ruth asks Boaz to be the kinsman redeemer, the guardian redeemer. That's the center of the book. And then there's 10 episodes after. So, and it is a chiastic structure in which at the center is this pivotal request. But if you compare, like, the beginning is on Naomi, the end is on Naomi. And just you can parallel that. Boaz comes from Bethlehem. Boaz is in Bethlehem. It just patterned after that. All to just show the artistry of putting this together in a way that is kind of rhyming. It's rhyming the story. And it's done in such a way, I think, to help, and you could understand it more in a non-Western context, help in the memory of telling the story. You had 10 things to have to say before you get to the pivotal point. And you have 10 things to say after. And that's how you would tell the story orally. I'm not prepared to do that without the text for you this afternoon. The book of Judges concluded with the Israelites desperate, if you recall, to repopulate the tribe of Benjamin after having almost annihilated them. You remember how Judges closes with this terrible scene of them coming down so hard on Benjamin because Benjamin had not helped. Wives were obtained for the 600 surviving Benjamites by sparing 400 young women from the slaughter of Jabesh-Gilead and then stealing another 200 from Shiloh. The storyline leaves the impression that Israel is just as bad as her pagan neighbors. There's hard to find anything that is redemptive in the closing account of Joshua. And then Bethlehem, the Levite, that is storied twice in the epilogue, is from the hill country of Ephraim and from Bethlehem. So the book of Ruth rehabilitates the meaning of Bethlehem. Because Bethlehem is a disaster at the end of Judges. But Bethlehem becomes a place of redemption in the book of Ruth. Another aspect in just introing here, living in Israel when the judges judged was not easy for anyone, but especially difficult for women. Since each man, and Stephen Pohl in his commentary says, that gender specificity is important here. Each man did what was right in their own eyes, and women suffered. Judges is full of stories, Fowle writes, about men doing what's right in their own eyes in ways that often result in disaster for women. Rape, murder, and ultimately civil war. Thus the famous line, Israel had no king, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And that's what makes this description of one family very interesting in the book of Ruth. So I'm reading from chapter 1 and verse 1 from this book that was placed after Proverbs as kind of a story in the Hebrew Bible, placed after Proverbs as a kind of fuller description, we believe, of Proverbs 31. And all part of the wisdom scrolls. Chapter 1, verse 1 of Ruth. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech. My father is king, or God is king. His wife's name was Naomi, pleasantness. happiness. And the names of her two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Now, Mahlon means sickly and weak. Chilion means pining, whining, wasting away. I have heard sermons where preachers go off on this. Who would name their children sickly and pining? I think it's, you know, I guess I don't want to be distracted by how they name their children. And especially I don't want to turn it into something that's humorous, because I do think that it is Elimelech's and Naomi's sad way of describing their plight. In the Jewish Talmud, they argue that Elimelech forsook God's law by leaving Bethlehem, by leaving Judah, and going to live in Moab. And you remember Abraham left to go to Egypt because of the famine. You remember Jacob left to join his son Joseph in Egypt because of the famine. I'm disinclined to be critical of Elimelech for taking his family to some place where he hoped to be able to feed them. So I don't see him here. And yeah, you know, there's so much implicit in the biblical story that almost begs you to read into it. What does this mean? What does it mean for them to name their children this way? What does it mean for Elimelech to leave Bethlehem to go to Moab, which is outside of the promised land and outside of the people of God? So in the Talmud, in verse 3, now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and so they attribute his death to his leaving. But I just don't, see that as the point of the story, therefore I'm reluctant to use that as an explanation for his death. I'm telling you, I guess, back it up, I don't want to take anything away from Naomi's genuine, real grief. So I see Naomi as a Job figure. And in some ways, she out-Jobs Job. And that probably, if you come to that kind of conclusion about Naomi, it does sort of control your interpretation of her throughout the book. She was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women. And again, do we read a lot into this about how wrong it was for the Hebrew people to intermarry with Moabites? You remember where Moab began? It's described in Genesis 35. With the fall of Sodom, Lot and his two daughters are living in a cave. The daughters want to extend their family, have children, so they get Lot drunk one night, and the oldest daughter has sex and is impregnated with Lot. And then the next night, the younger daughter does. From those pregnancies, the oldest daughter gave birth to a child named Moab. The youngest daughter gave birth to a child named Amnon. The Ammonites and the Moabites come from Lot. So that's the history way back of the Moabite situation. Verse 4, they married Moabite women, one named Orpha and the other Ruth. And after they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died. And Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. So you can list in your mind what Naomi is suffering. A grieving widow who's lost both sons and has two somewhat dependent daughters-in-law that had thought they were married into a family that would be some security for them. So Naomi is in a situation that is equally difficult to anything that Job experienced. Remember, Job too loses his family, he doesn't lose his wife, but that destitution is real for Naomi. Verse 6, when Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. Well, that must have been quite a journey. You can see on the map that traveling from Moab up to Bethlehem was difficult, was long. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. So, like Abraham, like Jacob, there is a return. Verse 8, then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness, hesed, that love that so often refers to God's gracious, undeserved love. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. It is interesting, they start on the journey, but somewhere along the line in that journey, Naomi, what is she thinking? Is she thinking, I have a sad life. It's only going to get sadder. I'm going to go home with nothing. I've lost my husband. Why am I taking two daughters-in-law with me? Somewhere along the line, she felt the pressure of that. May the Lord show you kindness if you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. And then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, we will go back with you to your people. Well, they both say that here. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I'm old. I'm too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? Which is her way of saying, I have no control over what might come into your life. I cannot improve your life. No, my daughters, it's more bitter for me than for you because the Lord's hand has turned against me. First item on the outline, I have Naomi's lamentation. And we seek to interpret that lamentation. We learn from Naomi to cut out all the secondary causes and go right to the source. It's more bitter for me than for you because the Lord's hand has turned against me. Could we talk of a plague that killed Mahlon and Chilion? Could we talk of cancer that killed Elimelech? Could we talk about the destitution that was going through Judah and famine that led to the move to Moab? There's so many different causes that you would kind of like to know. You'd like to get behind the story. You'd like to understand why this condition. But we don't get that. I'd suggest to you that the Lord isn't, that this isn't wrong for Naomi to say, it's the Lord's hand against me. All throughout the Psalms, we have the psalmist cutting through secondary causes. on Psalm 44, I wrote this. Hopefully this will help to say clearly what I'm trying to say. We ought to credit the psalmist with the courage of his convictions. Since God is sovereign over all, the psalmist has no one else to go to but God. He skips the stress of second-guessing and figuring out secondary causes. He does not conjure up false guilt and blame himself or others. Nor does he distract himself with false idols and false hope. And it says, it's the Lord's hand against me. We probably hesitate with this because we don't want to contribute to a bad reputation for the Lord. But I think if we're seeing it in a more biblical light, rather than eating yourself up with resentment or bitterness or some secondary cause, some cause that's out there that either you blame yourself or you blame others, Naomi has the peace to just say, "It's the Lord is sovereign. And this happened to me. The Lord's hand is against me." I think that's a good truth when it comes to lamentation, is to put it in the Lord's hands. This isn't an accusation, though. Like, she's not blaming herself. I don't think she's blaming God. But it's under the Lord's sovereign hand. I think as Westerners, we have trouble with that. We certainly have trouble with crediting the Lord for someone else's suffering, right? But we're not crediting the Lord with someone else's suffering. So, do we have the right, given all the nature of secondary causes, to say, the Lord's hand is against me? When my father died, when I got cancer, when my mother had a heart attack, the Lord's hand is against us. I think that comes close to true lament, true crying out to God, acknowledging God's sovereignty over your whole situation. So I don't see Naomi as a complainer, but as a lamenter. Verse 14, at this they wept aloud. And then Orpha kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. And I don't know, I can't bring myself to blame Orpha for leaving. Again, in going through the commentaries, I'm checking all these things that, well, I don't know as if that's the point. Ruth clung to Naomi, and that's from Genesis 2:24, a man shall leave his mother and father and cling to his wife. It's the same word of this deep intimacy, of connection, of relating, of depending. But I don't think Orpha, the fact that she kissed her mother-in-law, Naomi has already accounted for Orpha's kindness to her. I still don't think that's part of the story. The story is just Ruth. So it's interesting in this interpretation where you are having to see that there's ways that you could misinterpret Naomi saying, the Lord is against me. And I think those misinterpretations is what's wrong, not the fact that she laments the Lord's sovereign control over her life. And that Orpha leaves and Ruth clings and Orpha's wrong for doing that. Again, I don't think that's the point of the story. Obviously, there's so much here that you could take differently than I'm taking. And I'll give you permission to do that. You can take it differently. But as you move through the story, you're trying to understand it, trying to interpret it. I think bottom line, we'll be all on the same page. Verse 16, but Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to return back from you. Where you go, I will go. Now we're moving from Naomi's lamentation to Ruth's commitment. Naomi got into the story through her lamentation, but now Ruth picks it up. Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be ever so severely. And your translation, it'll be interesting here. If even death separates you from me. That's probably different from what some of you have. If anything but death. But this NIV translation is, if even death, so death cannot separate us. It's not everything but death. Even death cannot separate us. Which echoes Romans 8. Verse 18, when Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Let me just itemize a few of the things that I think Ruth's commitment to Naomi brings out. First, Ruth owned the decision for herself. Don't urge me to leave you. And Ruth freed Naomi from feeling responsible for her. That may have been the reason why Naomi wanted to part company with them both. She couldn't bear further responsibility at this point with having no resources and nothing to give to her daughters-in-law. But Ruth has freed her from that responsibility. Secondly, she affirmed in the strongest terms her identity and solidarity with Naomi and her people. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God, my God. Stephen Fowle, in his commentary, writes, such kinship of soul, rather than kinship based on common DNA, matches the new family that Jesus forms in us. So that faith is thicker than blood, according to the point that Ruth is making with Naomi. In the strongest terms, she is affirming her commitment to Naomi and her people and her God. Thirdly, Ruth stressed that this was a decision for life. Naomi was an older woman, many years older than Ruth, and she could be expected to die years before Ruth, but Ruth pledged her commitment to her for life. Where you die, I will die. So I am really buying into this altogether. Fourth and finally, Ruth invokes the name of Yahweh, the Lord. It was not a generic religious commitment. She evidenced a personal relationship with the Lord for herself. She pledged, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. In other words, may the Lord be between you and me forever and ever and ever. Wouldn't we have to conclude that Naomi's life before God was so real that it encouraged Ruth to make this decision? So whatever we've thought about Elimelech and Naomi and their relationship with God and leaving Bethlehem for Moab and what they have suffered and Naomi's lament, it's so real with God that Ruth frames her decision to stay with Naomi in terms of her God. Makes you think of the Jonathan and David conversation. May the Lord be between you and me and my generation and your generation, your seed and my seed. 1 Samuel 20, verse 42.
Naomi's life before God was so real that it encouraged Ruth to join her and become part of God's salvation story. Now, what I would do as a pastor here in preaching this would be to draw out the implications of Naomi's witness through companionship. I think that may be the strongest kind of witness that we can give to the good news of the gospel. Simple, faithful companionship. Ruth had been with Naomi, and she has been, in a sense, theologized and evangelized and edified through Naomi's witness. In verse 18, we have Naomi's reaction. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Now, that's also another aspect of the companionship. Naomi doesn't promise Ruth anything. Now, Eugene Peterson takes off on this idea of not promising Ruth anything on the nature of the American church and the propensity we have to promise to new converts a lot of things that would appeal to sort of a spiritually consumer society. Your life's going to go better. Your family's going to go better. You're going to be more successful. This is going to put everything together. Now, let's not make too much of it, but I would underscore Naomi's companionship and the fact that she simply accepts Ruth's devotion and commitment without promising something in return. One of the issues of the Lay Academy is this is something to be discussed. You know, like in a Bible study, we would really stop and discuss this now. And it would be edifying to have that discussion. But somehow this just doesn't work for that and also being taped, I guess. But I think there'd be a benefit from us discussing how the church operates in such a way as to not make false promises. Because Jesus, when he emphasized that conversion process, it was take up your cross and follow me. It wasn't an easy road. It was a complex and more difficult, challenging road to follow him. And that's what he emphasized. We cannot and should not say that your life will be easier with Christ. And Naomi's example of silence here is telling. So Naomi and Ruth arrive in Bethlehem. Notice it's still all part of chapter 1. The chapters, of course, are arbitrary in terms of their organization. Verse 19, so the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the woman explained, can this be Naomi? I don't know. How do you read the lines there? Has Naomi changed a lot in appearance? Is it the suffering of at least 10 years? The bereavement of a husband, the loss of two sons? Can this be Naomi? Don't call me Naomi. I can hear a grandson say that. Don't call me Naomi. Don't, she told him, call me Mara, or bitterness, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Now, that's a little bit of an exaggeration because they left because of famine. So I don't know how full. But the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me a Naomi? You've got to hear this. I mean, this is theatrical. It's dramatic. The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. I'm inclined to just let it stand. That's what she said. I think that her lamentation is honest and true. And I think we need to hear it as a genuine, honest lamentation. Gives us all wisdom in terms of both how we lament and how we hear other people lamenting. Job sounded very similar. I agree with the roots of evil. And God is not the author of evil. But can we see this as a lament that isn't blaming God, but crediting God with His sovereignty over her life in every way? And if I can say it again, I think the Psalms, characteristically, the psalmist does the same thing. Credits the Lord with what's wrong, what he's or she experiencing in life, which is really different, because I think we really want to guard the truth of the Lord and His goodness and His mercy. So, and this isn't like in the funeral line, you know, this was God's will for you, that kind of cliched, empty, thoughtless, uncompassionate response. And this is Naomi speaking. It's not the women at Bethlehem saying, oh man, the Lord judged you for going to Moab. The Lord judged you with the death of your husband. You are under judgment. That's not what's being said. It's, don't call me happy. Call me bitter. And this is what has happened, and it's under the Lord. That's a different kind of spirituality than we may be accustomed to. Well, and Naomi, we're going to discover quickly, is a really positive person. And she really is thinking through how the Lord's going to continue working in her life. So rather than blaming, I see this more as an issue of honesty under the sovereignty of God, said by the right person at the right time, not by the wrong people in the wrong time. So bottom line it, we are learning something about lamentation in this account. That's how I see it. Preachers would take it in a variety of ways. Verse 22 says, Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite. Now, Ruth the Moabite is going to be said seven times. I think we know that Ruth is from Moab. So why will this be said seven times?
Same reason Rahab is called a harlot.
Right, exactly. We're reminded over and over again of God's grace to somebody outside of the ethnic people of God. The Moabite is going to become an Israelite. And this is God's doing. This is more the story than the marriage of Boaz and Ruth, I think. Her daughter-in-law arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning, which this is one reason why Ruth is attributed to, in celebration in Judaism, to Pentecost and to the giving of the law at Sinai, and associated with the Feast of Weeks. Chapter 2. Let me see. Again, I have a few itemized things that I just want to run through in terms of Naomi coming into Bethlehem. The reception, I would draw our attention to, was a sign of blessing. They receive her. And implied in this is receiving her warmly, not judgmentally. So her hometown people were excited to see her. The outcome would certainly have been different if no one had cared. Now, again, this is a different kind of picture of Bethlehem than the Bethlehem that produced the Levite that married the concubine, that chopped up the concubine. This is rehabilitating Bethlehem. And it coincided, a second blessing, with the harvest, as I've said. And, of course, the law stipulated about gleaning, and that's going to come into the picture from Leviticus 19. It talks about farmers leaving, not clearing their field completely, harvesting everything, but leaving it for the poor to be able to glean from the field. The third blessing is just the goodwill of the people. As a foreigner, a Moabite, Ruth might have been targeted for discrimination, but instead we're going to learn that the people respect Ruth for staying with Naomi. That gives her a lot of credit. The people of Bethlehem delighted in the story of Ruth. Naomi arrived home to a community shaped by the commands of God. And this is a first. We haven't realized how the law has shaped. All through Judges, we kept saying, where is the law? Where is the law of God? It seems like they have totally forgotten it. But this is a glimpse into the fact that this community has been shaped by God's will, by God's law. So Naomi's lamentation, her lament, and Ruth's devotion, and now we come to Boaz. Verse 1 of chapter 2, now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing, or man of nobility. Now, we don't know whether Boaz actually means strong or quick. As it turns out, Boaz is both strong and quick. Man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz, and Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor. And Naomi said to her, go ahead, my daughter. So she went out and entered a field and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Now, we don't know a lot about Boaz. He was a man of strong character, apparently a man that had some means and provision and land and was a successful farmer. He probably was married, probably had a wife, had children, was older. There's nothing in here that would imply that he's a single older man waiting for somebody to marry. Just then, verse 4, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem. And Boaz's arrival from Bethlehem is all part of the drama. And greeted the harvesters, the Lord be with you. The first thing that Ruth hears is the word from Boaz, the Lord be with you. Now, you could be a little romantic at this point. Those first encounters are always something that are pretty memorable and stay with you, even though they might be quite ordinary. The Lord be with you. An aside here, my first encounter with my wife, I was a senior at Wheaton College teaching a course with Bob Weber, for some of you that name might ring a bell, on Christ and culture. And they used for a textbook H. Richard Niebuhr's book, Christ and Culture. I had taken it before when I was a freshman, and so I had sold my book. Now I can't understand why students sell their books, but back then I sold my books. Virginia had posted selling Niebuhr's book because she had just taken the course. And I called the number. We arranged to meet in the library for the exchange, and I'd buy her book. Well, when she got there, she wanted more money for the book than I could buy it new. So this freshman's arguing with me that her book was worth more because of the marginal notes in it. We really don't remember what I paid for it, but I did buy it, and then eventually started dating her.
So it was worth it, but it
It was worth it, yeah. I still have the book and the wife. The Lord be with you. Yahweh with you, a word of blessing. The Lord bless you, they answered. You're creating this image of a person that is well-respected and respected because of the Lord. Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, who does that young woman belong to? So Boaz has noticed her, which probably wouldn't be that hard in that culture to pick out the person who's a stranger, never seen before. The overseer replied, she is the Moabite who came back. We're driving that point home. Who came back from Moab with Naomi. And she said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters. And she came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. What is driving Ruth? I think we'd have to say her love for Naomi. She's a daughter-in-law that is committed to helping Naomi and provide food for both of them. Verse 8, so Boaz said to Ruth, my daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women. I have told the men not to lay a hand on you. And whenever you're thirsty, go and drink from the water jars the men have filled. At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. And she asked him, why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner? And we're all asking that question, aren't we? And the implication that some might bring to this is that Boaz was really attracted to Ruth. I don't think so. Boaz replied, I've been told all about you, all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland. How would they know that? Naomi's bragging on Ruth. Naomi has been telling this beautiful story. You know, the one who's called bitter is yet praising others and praising Ruth. And that's why the whole community knows how good and noble Ruth is. You came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. That is just beautiful. We have paid so much attention to Ruth's statement in chapter 1. I'll go where you go. I'll die where you die. Those are the poetic lines that seem to come most readily out of the book of Ruth. But I think Boaz's statement here, not to take anything away from Ruth, is also really important. And it is a theme, whose wings you have come under. The psalmist uses this all the time, this kind of imagery. Jesus used it in Matthew, this imagery, whose wings you have. If you want the specific, I have all of that. Matthew 23:37 is when Jesus used it, to be covered with your wings. But it's poetic, it's beautiful, answering the reason as to why Boaz notices Ruth. You get the feeling that he's actually pleased that she's shown up at his field because he's proud of her. Verse 13, and there is an age gap, I'm sure, here where Boaz is older. Verse 13, may I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord, she said. You have put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants. The whole picture is beautifully crafted, a picture of humility and a picture of compassion. Boaz's compassion for Ruth, Ruth's humility before Boaz. Verse 14, at mealtime, Boaz said to her, come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar. And when she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over.
And as she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men. I think this is on the side. Let her gather among the sheaves. Don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up. Don't rebuke her. So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. And then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah, which is 30 pounds. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked her, chapter one is compressing all of these years of suffering. When you get to chapter two and this encounter with Boaz, you get this long kind of, this is one day in the field. One day in the field constitutes the heart of the story. Her mother-in-law asked her, verse 19 is where I'm reading, where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. And then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz. And the Lord bless him. Yahweh bless him. The specific and personal name of the Lord. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, he has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers. Now, this is the thought I had in the middle of the night last night. The law shapes the community. So the principles of the Levitical marriage, the principles of the guardian redeemer are shaping this community in its understanding. But I guess what I was thinking in the night was, well, if Boaz knew about Ruth and knew how poor they were, why wouldn't you just be giving to them? The law provides for this gleaning. The law provides for this process. Would the New Testament community be further along so that a Boaz would identify a relative who is in great need and hearing the story of the integrity of their witness and Naomi's response to Ruth's response to Naomi, would the Christian not have taken the initiative to provide and not sort of, is this a law in grace story? That grace would take the initiative here. Law is setting it up so that there will be grace. But would in the Christian community be an initiative be taken? That was a middle of the night reflection. I do think that the structures and stipulations of the law here, which gives us a great story, and Boaz responds mercifully in the story, but I wonder if the Christian community would operate more freely, more graciously, more quickly. And somebody might say, probably if I had a younger crowd, they would say, or they just wouldn't respond at all. Wouldn't see any kind of, help. Okay. Verse 21, then Ruth the Moabite said, he even said to me, stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the women who work for him, because in someone else's field you might be harmed. That gives us more of a picture of Judges, doesn't it? So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvest were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. Why don't we take a five-minute break, refreshment, bathroom break, and we'll get right back to it. We have no extra time. We've got to finish today. We have no opportunity elsewhere.